Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled The Case of Mahmoud Khalil, Free Speech or National Security. Our moderator today is Casey Maddox. Casey is Vice President for Legal Strategy at Stand Together and Senior Advisor at Americas for Prosperity. In these roles, he advocates for and creates strategies and partnerships to ensure constitutionally limited government that protects the civil liberties of all Americans. Prior to joining Stand Together, Casey's legal career focused on defending the First Amendment rights of students, faculty, healthcare workers, and religious organizations. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A feature at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Casey, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Caroline. I'm very excited for this conversation. This is obviously a very important issue. It's one that is getting a whole lot of attention. And so thank you for tuning in. We have, I think, a great couple of people for this conversation. And I will give them very short introductions. Both my friends, Ilya Shapiro, first of all. Ilya is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. You may have seen him occasionally on Twitter when he makes his rare appearance on Twitter. Very glad to have Ilya join this conversation. Ilya was also—
especially on April Fool's Day, I'm always very somber on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Ilya, just to show you that we're all sort of a family here, Ilya was once represented by fire in a very prominent example that you can read more about in his recent book that he might mention at some point during this conversation with Georgetown. Thank you very much, Ilya. Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, his recent book. Ilya was represented in that case in his situation with Georgetown by fire. Connor Fitzpatrick, my friend at fire, is here and is the supervising senior attorney at fire. Among other things, he's been working on some of the questions around the Mahmoud Khalil case. And so I'm very excited to have the two of you here. As we have this conversation, basically what we're going to do is we'll have Connor go first and then Ilya with about 7 to 10 minutes in their sort of initial presentations. And then we'll have each of them give a short response to one another. I'll have a handful of questions that I will ask, but I expect that this is probably the kind of conversation that we will have a lot of questions from the audience on. So please put those questions in the Q&A function. And when we get there, I will we'll turn to those and start asking those questions. So, as you all know, Mahmoud Khalil is a Palestinian green card holder in the United States. He was detained by ICE on March 8th. He's presently, I believe, unless there are updates I don't know about, he's presently in Louisiana in a detention facility and faces potential deportation for his involvement in the, depending on how one views it, protests, disruptions at Columbia University related to the war between Hamas and Israel. U.S. government cites a particular immigration law provision that allows deportation if the secretary finds that there are serious adverse foreign policy consequences. Critics have argued that this is the government's action is in retaliation for his speech. So this is the conversation teed up. How exactly does the Constitution apply here? Is this a free speech question? Is it a national security question? Is it both? And so we'll start with Connor first.
Thank you, Casey, and thank you so much for having me today. Freedom of speech is core to the United States of America. Our history and tradition in the United States is that we respond to one idea with another idea. We use reason and logic to try and persuade others that someone's idea is wrong. And this goes back to the founding. In 1801, Thomas Jefferson delivered his first inaugural address. And in that address, he took time to defend the right of freedom of speech for those who called for dissolution of the Union. And he said that if anyone wishes to make that argument, let reason be free to combat them, but that we will never use the strong arm of government to silence an opinion or a view that we don't like. And that same principle should hold true today. Now, one proviso before we start talking about Mahmoud Khalil's case and the broader implications of free speech when it comes to some of these college protests. What we're not talking about today are folks who have actually committed crimes. As Casey mentioned, what the Secretary of State is relying on is a narrow provision of the INA allowing or purporting to allow the Secretary of State to deport somebody who he deems a foreign policy risk. So if somebody has actually committed vandalism or unlawful or harassment or any of the other of number crimes, any of the other crimes that could actually provide a lawful basis for deporting someone, that is a completely different kettle of fish, and that's not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is the idea that the Secretary of State can deem someone a threat to our foreign policy based on nothing more than speech that would be protected under the First Amendment if you or I had done it and throw them out of the country. We think that runs against America's traditions of free speech, and it runs against the First Amendment. And I'll address those two separately. The first is, I'll give a rundown of what is the law when it comes to freedom of speech for non-citizens, and then I'll do my best to make a case to all of you of why we should want to defend the freedom of speech for folks who aren't citizens of the United States. So first, what is the law? As is often when something like this comes up in the news, there are a whole lot of takes on Twitter. Most of them are wrong. So here's what we do know. What we do know is that in 1941, the United States Supreme Court in the case Bridges versus California invalidated the criminal convictions of four individuals, including a non-citizen, based on the fact that the conduct that the individuals engaged in was protected by the First Amendment. 4 years later, in Bridges versus Wixon, the Supreme Court again held that freedom of speech and of press is accorded to aliens residing in this country. That is a direct quote. So the idea that non-citizens simply don't have freedom of speech in the United States is just legally wrong. It's been wrong since 1945, and Wixon has never been overturned. Now, here's what we don't know. The Supreme Court has never definitively ruled on the question of whether the First Amendment prohibits something like Secretary of State Rubio is attempting now. The Supreme Court has never decided the interplay of what happens when someone's First Amendment rights come up against a deportation order from the executive branch. That is a question the Supreme Court hasn't addressed. However, we think it's logical to read Wixon as if non-residents really do have a right to freedom of speech, well, a right has to mean something. What is a right? A right means that you have the ability to do something without the government retaliating against you for exercising it. So in our view, if non-resident aliens have a right to freedom of speech, that means they have a right to voice their opinions as you and I do, and not be thrown in jail or thrown out of the country for it. Now, the second principle there that I think we should look at is just think about ordinary principles of First Amendment law, viewpoint discrimination and retaliation. It is unconstitutional in all but very, very narrow circumstances for the government to treat someone different based on a viewpoint that person is expressing. But if what we're saying is that the Secretary of State can deem someone a threat to foreign policy because the Secretary of State doesn't like the message that the speaker is voicing and believes that it's a threat to America's foreign policy, well, that's viewpoint discrimination. Because what it means is that if that person were expressing an idea that supported America's foreign policy, they would not be subject to the same sanction. That's the first problem. The second is think about ordinary principles of retaliation in First Amendment law. In First Amendment law, we look at whether you engaged in protected activity, whether the government took an adverse action against you because of it, and whether there's causation. So if what we're saying is that, yes, this non-citizen engaged in conduct that would have been protected by the First Amendment, there's an adverse action of kicking them out, which would certainly deter a person of ordinary firmness from wanting to speak out, and that's the test under established First Amendment law, and it was causation, what we're saying saying is that we should throw all of the usual principles of First Amendment law out when it comes to how we treat non-citizens. We don't think that it's a great idea to start throwing out core principles of constitutional law and depriving non-citizens of freedom of speech. So the second part I'd like to address sort of in my opening remarks here is why we should all want to protect the freedom of speech of non-citizens. And the first point is that it's hard for me to think of a more un-American sentence than watch what you say or else. Imagine you have a friend visiting you in the United States from another country, and you're going out to lunch or dinner, and you're talking about the issues of the day, and you ask them their opinion about something, and they say, well, I'd really like to tell you, but am I allowed to say what I really think? I think most Americans, we would kind of puff out our chest a little bit and say, well, this is America. Of course you can say what you think. But if that's no longer the law, if what we're telling people is that if you're not a citizen, if you don't have a blue passport with an eagle on it, that you have to watch what you say when you're in the United States, that is a radical transformation of how we treat freedom of speech in the United States, depriving people of their liberty, even though they are lawfully here, based on whether or not we like what they have to say. That's not the American approach to free speech. And think about the practical implications. Imagine you have a protest where three individuals are all chanting the same slogan. If the other side's approach is correct and certain messages and certain opinions can form the basis for someone to be deported if they're not a citizen, that means we're going to have a situation where law enforcement goes up to those three protesters and says, all right, everyone, let me see your papers. I need to make sure you're lawfully able to voice these opinions. That's not the way things work here. That is not the American approach to free speech. That approach is also ripe for abuse. Imagine if in 2006 or 2007, the George W. Bush administration had tried to deport John Oliver for his criticism of the Iraq War on The Daily Show. Or imagine if the Biden administration just a couple of years ago had tried to deport Nigel Farage, the UK politician, for attending the Republican National Convention. I would hope one, if not both of those examples should be entirely unacceptable to everyone on this call. And so what the First Amendment does and what principles of free speech do is that it ensures that the government has to remain neutral on matters of opinion. Now, all of this is especially odd considering that just a couple of months ago, Vice President Vance went to Europe and lectured our European allies, rightly so, on their deficiencies when it comes to free speech. And many of those deficiencies related to hate speech laws that have been passed in countries like the United Kingdom and Germany. But now what we're seeing this administration do is try to justify kicking people out of the United States for hate speech. So it's right now, it's a very much do as I say, not as I do message coming from this administration on free speech. The final point I'll make is that the core of the First Amendment has always been that we do not trust the government to create a right ideas and a wrong ideas basket and enforce it with the strong arm of the law. That's the truth of the First Amendment. So the idea that we can create free speech rights light for non-citizens and decide, okay, you're allowed to say these things, but we're not going to allow you to voice these other opinions. That runs contrary to the entire idea of the First Amendment, which is that it is not for the government to ever dictate to anyone, you shall not think these thoughts or you shall not voice those opinions. Yes, if someone throws a brick through a window or trespasses and occupies on a building or commits an actual crime, that can be a deportable offense and properly so. That's not what we're talking about. But what we're talking about is speech, is talk, is protest chants. And if what you're doing is handing out a flyer or chanting in a protest, that is core speech under the First Amendment. And it should not matter. And in our view, legally does not matter whether you have a passport that says United States of America or any other country on the planet.
Great.
Sorry, well, I was going to say, Connor, thank you very much, and hand over to Ilya, but I couldn't unmute myself.
Well, there was an awkward pause, so I'm like, okay, I'll just shift into my own thing now. Okay. I agree with a lot of that, and it's disconcerting to once again be on the other side of a debate with my friends at FIRE. Just to clarify, they helped me a lot with all sorts of crisis PR management and what have you, and provided my lawyer, Jesse Benall, who did a great job during the Georgetown Troubles, as some of my friends call it, But Fire's legal team did not directly represent me there, but I've worked with them on lots of other cases in the past and will continue to do so, no doubt. But as of late, there have been, this is, I think, the third big disagreement over national policy issues that I've had, including the TikTok divestiture issue and the age verification laws for porn sites, the Texas law that's at the Supreme Court. And the thing is, I think Fire is just here as well, making a category error. That is, Fire is the nation's leading advocate for the freedom of speech, which is why I love them so. And, am happy to help raise money for them and advocate for them and say that they're, the best thing since sliced bread. When all you do is free speech, then that's your hammer, and everything is a nail. And these cases, and specifically, of course, we're going to talk about the immigration area, is not about free speech. That is. Nobody is being prosecuted, regardless of their immigration status, legal, illegal, permanent, temporary, what have you, green card or otherwise, for speaking. It's not that, if you have a certain kind of immigration status, you can be fined for hate speech or whatever you want to call it. But if you're a citizen, then you can't. No, that's not it at all. It's about immigration regulations. And since time immemorial, we've had immigration regulations prohibiting the entry or calling for the removal of people who advocate for, say, the violent overthrow of the U.S. government, or for being a communist, or for being a Nazi, or as relevant to these cases, for advocating for terrorism. And that's what all that's going on here. It should be uncontroversial that any country, but specifically the United States, should get to choose who can enter the country, for how long, for what reason. And it should also be uncontroversial that one of the reasons that make you disqualified from getting a visa, if once you're here, makes you removable, if it becomes evident that you are indeed advocating for assorted things, including supporting terrorist activity. That's not the sort of people that I think we should want in the country for whatever reason. And now it looks like the Trump administration has started to act. I think I've seen a figure of about 400 visas being pulled so far. Obviously, Khalil is the highest profile. There's also a Turkish student, and we're not sure, the government hasn't yet revealed what the reasons. Is it, just one op-ed? That seems dubious to me. If the only reason is you're opposing Israeli policy in a student paper or something, that seems insufficient to meet the immigration regs that I'm about to go into. But who knows? The devil is going to be in the details in a lot of these cases. We also, I think, the news today or yesterday, a Cornell student, Mamadou Tal, has self-deported rather than fight some of these immigration rules against him. Look, it's a basic application of U.S. immigration law that says that people here on a visa, whatever kind of visa, tourist, student, employment, and up to a green card. And let's just pause here about the green card thing, because that distinguishes Khalil from all these other cases that I've seen, at least. The green card means, the permanent residency means, that he's entitled to more due process. He gets to have these judicial hearings. There's a higher standard. The government has to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that he has violated these various regulations. In other circumstances, you don't get that. That is, judges don't grant visas. You don't need judges to revoke them. It's an administrative action. So the green card thing is a matter of the amount of due process due, not the legal standards to apply. But anyway, people here on a visa who reveal themselves to be ineligible for that visa, or inadmissible in the language of the Immigration and Nationality Act, can have that visa revoked. I wrote in the Free Press in the aftermath of the October 7th attacks on Israel, the INA allowed the denial or revocation of a visa of, quote, any alien who endorses or espouses terrorist activity, or persuades others to endorse or espouse terrorist activity, or support a terrorist organization. That's language directly from, I think it's 8 U.S.C. 1127. I don't have the exact provision handy, but that's the language from it. And Biden's State Department told then-Senator Marco Rubio that it could revoke the visas of Hamas supporters. So not just an op-ed or what have you, but actually showing yourself to endorse or espouse terrorist activity, et cetera. But that's not all that the government can do. The INA's inadmissibility provision also empowers the president to, quote, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens whom he determines to be, quote, detrimental to the interests of the United States. And we saw that affirmed by the Supreme Court in the so-called travel ban litigation, Trump versus Hawaii. The court okayed an executive order restricting travel from various countries, with Chief Justice Roberts affirming that the only statutory requirement is the president find the entry of the affected alien to be detrimental to the national interest. Now, there are certain wrinkles with, for example, the Enemy Aliens Act, and you should be able to challenge in court whether, in fact, you are an alien enemy and all of that. We're seeing that play out. But in terms of people who are here on a visa, we can debate what the law is unclear on the point of just the Secretary of State determining that someone is against American foreign policy interests. What does that mean? I don't know. That hasn't been defined. It hasn't been fully litigated. So to the extent that Connor might press on hard cases at the margins of that provision, sure. That can ultimately be the hardest case. But ultimately, if you are a communist, a Nazi, an Islamist, you can be rejected, revoked, removed. You know, when I got my green card, I'm an immigrant myself. When I got my green card, and again, when I naturalized, I had to affirm that I wasn't affiliated with these kinds of groups or any other totalitarian party. Or to give another example in a different context, 5 years ago, 1,000 Chinese nationals had their visas revoked for being national security risks. A determination, again, against America's security interests, against our foreign policy interests. And the Biden administration successfully defended that Trump action in court. Again, these are core government functions. As the INA says, quote, the admission to the United States of any alien as a non-immigrant shall be for such time and under such conditions as the Attorney General may by regulations prescribe. All sorts of regulations here. So it's not about sending foreigners to jail for saying things the government doesn't like or for saying, you know, I don't like Trump's foreign policy. I don't like his tariffs, what have you. It's for advocating causes inimical to the United States. So I think there's nothing objectionable or controversial about removing those who harass, intimidate, vandalize, call for, you know, violent revolution or otherwise interfere with the government, with the educational institution's core mission. You don't need to have committed a crime. You don't need to have been charged, let alone convicted of a crime. But all of these things rightly make aliens removable.
Thank you, Ilya. And we'll go back to Connor. And I'll also just remind everyone, if you have questions, we have a number that have already come in. If you have questions, please submit them there. But Connor, you have a response?
I do. Thank you. So first, the idea that that Ilya mentioned that no one is being prosecuted, that's a distinction without a difference. And Justice Murphy addressed that point in his concurrence in Bridges versus Wixon. And he said that the idea that there's some sort of a distinction between the ability to throw a non-citizen in jail for their speech and deport them for their speech makes, quote, an empty mockery of human freedom, end quote. So the Supreme Court and Justice Murphy have already opined on that point. And the idea that someone, in order to keep their immigration status in the United States, needs to watch what they say and make sure not to criticize the government, it is hard for me to think of a less American approach to free speech than that. The second thing that I'd like to respond to is that Ilya talked a lot about the regulations applicable to when people are applying for a visa and coming into the country. That is a completely different legal kettle of fish than the rights of what happens when you're already here. And we have a Supreme Court case on that. It's the Kleinstadt case. And he is absolutely right that when somebody is applying for a visa, when you are at the immigration gate trying to get into the United States, the executive branch does have a considerable amount more leeway when it comes to deciding whether to let you in or not. But the core holding of Wixon, the core holding of Bridges, and these are holdings that just last October were echoed by Judge Thapar in the Sixth Circuit, is that once you're in the United States and you're here legally and abiding by our laws, you are entitled to the protections of freedom of speech. The next point that Ilya talked about is he mentioned these provisions in the Immigration Act about terrorist supporters and terrorist sympathizers. I think it's very important that everybody here knows that in all of the students so far that we're aware of that have been detained, this administration has not relied on the terrorism provisions of the INA at all. They have only been relying on the provision that allows the Secretary of State to personally determine that someone is a foreign policy threat to the United States. And let's be honest, these are individual grad students at Columbia and Tufts and Georgetown. The idea that a single grad student in a one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn is impeding the foreign policy of the United States is absurd. And the final point that I'd like to respond to is that Ilya mentioned with respect to this foreign policy provision that he doesn't know what it means and nobody knows what it means. That's the problem. And indeed, the only time this statute has ever been addressed by a court was back in 1996, ironically, by President Trump's sister judge, Judge Barry in the District of New Jersey. She found that this law was void for vagueness and unconstitutional. Now, that decision was overturned by the Third Circuit on unrelated procedural grounds. But there is a core flaw in this statute that this administration is relying on, which is that, as Ilya conceded, nobody knows what it means. So right now, if you have a green card or you have a visa and you're in the United States, the only way you can be extra sure that you're not going to get deported for your opinions is to never voice them. And that is not the American approach to free speech.
Well, let me tell you, when I was on a student visa, I was certainly careful. I was grateful for the opportunity and long wanted to be an American was careful in what I did. I was certainly, wrote for the school paper, various provocative things, what have you, but did not come close to the line of advocating terrorism or the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. Again, advocating for the violent overthrow of the government is different than simply criticizing government policy and with respect to that relevant provision. Some people have said to me, I got a question from a reporter, wouldn't what you say chill the speech of these students? I'm like, well, frankly, I'm not concerned about, someone shying away from the line of, am I on the right side of calling for the violent overthrow of the government or supporting terrorism or not? There's a lot of leeway there until you get anywhere close to that gray area, whatever it might be there. But as Connor said, for some reason, in most of these cases, or at least the high profile ones, the government is not relying on those provisions that I said, certainly not in the Khalil case for some reason, although the Khalil case has an additional wrinkle with respect to fraud that apparently he didn't disclose certain things about his activities when he was in England and thing is work for UNRWA and what have you. That's a separate kind of wrinkle. But I think it's less important to debate the particularities of any one case and more important talk about these general provisions, which can and should be more broadly applied to clean up the mess that's going on with the harassment and intimidation and vandalism and disruption and all sorts of stuff on our campuses, especially with respect to students and in broader society more general. So the government must have some sort of reason for relying on this discretion of the Secretary of State. They must anticipate that is the provision that's most vulnerable to legal challenge, that invites legal challenge, rather than the ones that I quoted about espousing terrorist activities or doing a whole host of things that these demonstrations, which are, we can make fun of, make an allusion to the summer of Floyd and talk about mostly peaceful protests or something like this. But these are massive mob-like domestic terrorism. And I think there's plenty of legally safe and uncontrovertible very uphill to challenge provisions that are there for these cases. I don't know whether they just like having the, Marco Rubio have a lot of wiggle room or what have you. But certainly if at the end of the day, we have a definitive Supreme Court case defining the parameters of that provision. That would be a healthy thing to give guidance to everyone.
Excellent. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions here that maybe two or three questions that will hopefully identify some places where there's some agreement or potentially sharpen the differences that we can go into questions from the audience. And you guys are supplying those. I think we're up to 22 already in the Q&A, which is not surprising given the topic. So I'm going to first begin with, one of the things that I'm sort of taking from this conversation is, to some degree, it seems like we're operating on some different facts in terms of what exactly is the basis right now for the action against Mahmoud Khalil. And so, Ilya, we'll come to you first, and then Connor, what's your understanding of what the administration is actually arguing as the basis for his removal?
Well, I haven't looked at the charging documents or the, however you do, I don't know if it's called charging document because it's, again, not a criminal matter. They referenced just this foreign policy, inimical to foreign policy, and then they added the fraud. There might be another thing in the amended charge, but the government hasn't fully revealed its hand, I don't think. They don't have to. I'm sure they'll bring in evidence when this hearing finally happens. I guess we had a ruling last week, I think, or the week before, that it's under the jurisdiction of the District of New Jersey. And so neither Louisiana, where he's being held, nor New York, where he was living, but New Jersey somehow. And anyway, we'll eventually have the hearing and figure that out. Again, I think there's plenty of basis for removing him. I imagine now the fraud thing is going to ultimately take center stage, because it's kind of a very objective up or down sort of scenario. Khalil is one of the leaders, one of the representatives, one of the organizers of the mob action, of the takeovers of Hamilton Hall. This is, you know, it's surprising to me that, say, Judiciary Democrats tweeted out support for him, or that he's being made into a martyr for free speech. There are much better cases that could be chosen.
Okay, Connor?
Sure. So a couple of thoughts there. The first is that Ilya is right that in the latest notice to appear that the government filed in the Khalil case, that they added on, I believe it was two counts of things he should have disclosed on a visa application about a year and a half ago that he didn't. I think Ilya and I are both sort of debating primarily the impact and what the impact should be of the foreign policy determination. You know, I concede if there are separate lawful, you know, justifications under the INA related to the reporting and the paperwork you have to do be lawfully in the country, that doesn't impact on free speech. That's something that impacts everyone equally. And I think so far, Ilya and I's discussion is largely focused on the foreign policy on the foreign policy justification. The second thing that I would like to point out is that Ilya talked at the end about this idea that he's that Mahmoud is a ringleader, that he was leading all of these protests and horrible things at the university. And I think it's really important to focus on the goods that the government actually has here when it comes to Mahmoud Khalil. Presumably, if the government actually had evidence that he was participating in vandalism, participating in any of the building occupations, participating in something that amounted to unlawful harassment, they would have supplied it by now. You know, one hopes so. They've detained him in Louisiana, far away from his 8-month pregnant wife. It would seem to be the government's responsibility to actually present that. But they haven't done that. What they've done so far is they pointed at some of his advocacy. And White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt specifically pointed to some of the posters that they allege he was handing out at one of the protests as a way to frame him as anti-American and pro-Hamas and anti-Israel. And so if what we're talking about as a justification for deporting this man is just speech, it's just protesters, it's just posters, it's just opinions, that is not an appropriate basis to kick someone out of the country. Yes, if he was involved in actually facilitating illegal activity, charge him with conspiracy, charge him with a crime. But don't use all of the things that happened at Columbia, mention that Mahmoud was also a pro-Palestine protester, and then try to graft all of the bad things that happened at Columbia onto Mahmoud. If he did something that violated the law, bring the goods, show the evidence showing what he did, but he shouldn't be held responsible for the illegal actions of others.
You don't have to be charged with a crime, let alone convicted, to be deportable. And one response to a previous thing that I should have noted is that I don't think this case is about speech. It's about, you know, speech acts, organizing, what have you, being a representative. He apparently was talking to the media and things like this, videos that we've seen. Yeah, and handing out flyers if they advocate terrorism, that clearly meets the statutory requirements. Again, I don't know why the notice to appear from the government didn't reflect that, but I'm curious about it. We just don't know. Maybe it'll come out later, but regardless, you don't need speech, but even speech can be enough. Again, quote, any alien who endorses or espouses terrorist activity or persuades others to endorse or espouse terrorist activity or support a terrorist organization. Now, there are speech acts there. Some of that might be speech. To put it very concretely, not the Khalil case or any others that we've seen, but a very, you know, steel man hypothetical. If you come into the country, and by the way, the standards for revoking the visas are pretty much the same. There's different process than if you don't, than if not getting it in the first place. But if you make a speech saying, you know, and that's why I'm a Nazi who wants to violently overthrow the government and we should all, you know, shoot every agent of the government that we see, forget whether you can be charged criminally under Brandenburg and incitement and all the rest of it. As a matter of immigration law, that speech is makes you removable. So even if you satisfied the requirements to get a visa, once you come to the U.S., if you start advocating stuff that, you know, meets the various requirements, you become removable. I don't think there should be anything controversial about that. Again, we want people who want to come to this country and contribute it and to it and all the rest of it. So, again, the basis for deporting all these folks is not speech, but speech acts and coordination with support for terrorism and things like that. But in the strong case, speech alone can make you removable.
My understanding is that there is at least one instance. So you have speech things, and I always get, and I will confess, I get very nervous around the idea of speech acts because I never know what this is going to mean. But if you like, for example, my understanding is that that Khalil had participated in a sit-in at Barnard College. Right now, on one hand, those of us in the civil liberty space think of sit-ins as, it's not protected speech. You're actually trespassing somewhere. It's illegal to do that. Normally, the consequence for doing that is, and then you spend the night in jail, or you're arrested and released, and now you've got to deal with a misdemeanor trespassing charge or whatever else, right? And that's the choice you make. So, but it, would that have been, if the administration had simply said, we are citing an example of, you know, like there may be more that comes, but you have participated in a non-protected activity that disrupted a university, and it was illegal to do so, right? And the consequence for you, for other people, that consequence might have been, you've got to deal with a misdemeanor and you've got to go down to civil court. Here for you, it's deportation. So I'll ask Connor first and then Ilya for your thoughts on examples like that, right? If it was a non-speech act, could that be a basis for deportation if that was the only thing that was happening here?
Sure. So if what was happening is that there's evidence that he actually committed a crime, something that if you or I had done, it would be punishable under the United States law, and there were a corresponding provision in the INA allowing deportation for conduct of that sort, we would be having a very, very different conversation. Now, I'll be candid. I'm not aware of the evidence you're describing relating to him being involved in an illegal sit-in at Barnard. I haven't come across that, but I know Casey very well. I certainly take him at his word. What we focused our position on and what I focus on is the administration's justification that they've provided to the public and to Mr. Khalil for why they're attempting to deport him. And from what we've found from the statements, both from the press secretary, President Trump, and Secretary of State Rubio, they've been relying on his posters. They've been relying on the messages that occurred at the protests that he was at, but I haven't seen them actually relying on any unlawful conduct. And then the final minor point I would make, just to briefly respond to Ilya, where he's been talking about different provisions of the INA, you know, not to be overly glib, but the Constitution trumps a federal statute. You know, Ilya, you know, thinks he has a couple provisions of the INA. I have the First Amendment.
Well, foreigners don't have the same First Amendment, right? They can't, you have to have a green card to be able to donate to a political campaign, for example. So there are things like that. Generally, they do. I mean, in the sense that you can't be prosecuted for it. And the Justice Murphy quote is all well and good. But as Casey raised, there are certain things that have much more serious consequences by definition, because deportation is a serious consequence, even if you're not thrown in jail. than others. You know, getting a DUI can get you deported. Getting, you know, a certain kind of speeding ticket, if it's aggravated speeding or whatever it's called in different state codes, could get you, in theory, deported. Lots of things that we might not think are, oh, well, that person, you know, committed, you know, some sort of violent crime or whatever that we think of what makes, you know, the Trenda Arengua gangs and, you know, human trafficking, all that stuff. It doesn't have to reach that level to make someone removable or ineligible for a visa. So, you know, the main problem, and I share Connor's concern about the vagueness issue, not about the, you know, viewpoint discrimination or content-based discrimination of the foreign policy related provision, but that it fails to provide sufficient notice of, you know, what you have to do to remain eligible to be in the country.
Well, this is great. I'm going to now turn to some questions from the audience. We do have about 20 minutes for those. So if you have not put your question in and you've got one, feel free to do that. So I think one of the questions that comes up here is one basically trying to figure out what are the how would this work if the shoe was on the other foot, right? And part of this goes, like, I guess, to the broadness of this power given to the Secretary of State. So you've got first of all, the determination by the executive branch that something is or that an entity is a terrorist organization, right? And then the secretary being able to decide that something is in conflict with the foreign policy interests of the United States, which would certainly seem to support opposition, you know, if you're supporting any terrorist organization, right? So even if we're just limiting it to advocacy for terrorism, I'll use this question here. What about if you have a future president who decides that they're going to deport non-US citizens who are legal residents in the US, who they deem to be engaged in nationalistic terrorism, support for January 6th, or something of that nature, right? Perhaps not even being whether you're present at January 6th or you were just someone who tweeted positively about what happened on January 6th. Would that be the kind of thing, like, how would you analyze that, Ilya?
Given how broad the provision is, it would, it would qualify, you know, if the different administration had a radically different position towards the Israel-Gaza war, then, you know, and we switch sides, say, then certainly you could be against the foreign policy. But then that goes to this, something you mentioned earlier with how does a grad student, you know, kind of hanging out in their studio in Morningside Heights or wherever, who might have a blog post or a Facebook post or joins a demonstration. How is that really going against the foreign policy interests of America? And I don't know. I don't know how you draw that line. Is it the number of followers you have to determine how influential you are? Is it, an allegation without a formal criminal charge of harassment or intimidation? Is it allusion to violence? I don't know. This all kind of collapses into the amount of discretion that's given to the Secretary of State. But certainly, if it's simply, you know, against America's foreign policy interests, then you look at what America's foreign policy interests are, whatever the government of the day might say, and then you start handing out flyers advocating, you know, for violence against the side that America supports. All of a sudden, you're, you know, in theory, against America's foreign policy interests.
Connor?
I would say I'm not sure that sounds like any America, you know, I've heard of or would really want to live in. The idea that that millions of people lawfully in this country, that the opinions they're allowed to hold and voice depends on who won the last presidential or congressional election, that seems very antithetical to 200 plus years of American free speech. Now, the second point, and I get where Ilya is coming from in sort of in terms of the difficulty of drawing the line. But the reason that line is so difficult to draw is why we have the First Amendment, is because we've never been able to come up with a satisfactory explanation for when thoughts are so dangerous that the government should be allowed to punish them. So unlike Germany and Sweden and Denmark and the United Kingdom, who think in their wisdom they have, you know, they can decide which opinions are so abhorrent that they can be banned, we codify our free speech principles in the First Amendment precisely because of the line drawing difficulties that Ilya was talking about. And so the way to solve this is to make sure everyone is on the same playing field, which is that if you are lawfully in the United States, you are allowed to voice your opinions consistent with the protections and the limitations of the First Amendment. But if you break the law, like anyone else, you can have severe consequences, up to and including deportation. But trying to create free speech light for a class of tens of millions of people lawfully in the United States is very tricky business, and one we've never really been able to solve.
So, Connor,
but you can't give money to political candidates as a foreigner. Are you saying that the United States government should not be able to keep out people who say, I am a Nazi, I am a radical Islamist, without charging them with terrorism or without having evidence that in their country, while they're applying for a visa, they were engaged in, Nazi activities or something like that? I don't think that's right.
So two responses there to both of your points. The first, with respect to campaign contributions, and I believe this was in Judge Thapar's opinion last October, the reason for that distinction is that non-citizens can't vote. And so they have a fundamentally different interaction with the electoral system than you or I might do, because you and I would be contributing to a campaign in order to, you know, influence something that we can vote in and participate in the democratic process. Non-citizens, of course, can't vote. So there is a reason for that distinction. The second example you gave of somebody who's looking to come in from Europe, potentially espousing Nazi ideology, again, we're getting to, there's a fundamental difference recognized in the law, recognized by the Supreme Court, of when you're not in the United States and you're seeking entry into the United States versus when you're actually here. And I can see that when someone is applying for a visa, when they are saying, please let me into your country, the executive branch has been granted a significant amount more authority to consider what would otherwise be protected speech when allowing people in. And I think, you know, I think there are arguments both ways on that, but I think that's a much closer call when it comes to free speech principles. But what we're talking about here is, once you're in the United States of America, once you're in Wichita, Kansas, should the name on your passport, should the insignia on the front of your passport dictate what opinions you are and aren't allowed to voice? And our position is that it shouldn't.
Well, to paraphrase J.D. Vance, I don't care, Margaret, Connor, whether you are already radicalized when you're applying for the visa or you become radicalized when you're in the country. If you're a foreigner who starts espousing what I think are well-crafted provisions in the INA, the ones that I quoted, not the very broad, you know, inimical to American foreign policy standard, but the ones that are more crafted in there, I think it is the same standard, because we can't deport domestic Nazis or domestic communists, you know, U.S. citizens, but foreigners who come here and start advocating and espousing and convincing others to do these things that are harmful to our own society and to our way of life, I think there is nothing wrong and should be uncontroversial that we can kick those people out.
Casey, one quick rejoinder on that. And what I would say is that if you accept the idea that Ilya and others have posited, that all there has to be is a provision in the INA and then the executive branch can use its authority, there's no limiting principle there. If that's true and the government of the day through legislation can dictate which opinions are and aren't in the national interest, imagine either a Republican or a Democratic Congress that has a supermajority and the presidency passing a law that says you are only eligible for a green card and then potential citizenship if we believe your characteristics and background are such that you are likely to be either a Democrat/Republican voter, insert or delete at will. There's no limiting principle to the idea that we are going to define certain bad ideas and that those are definable, that we can all agree upon, and that should result in your deportation from the country. The far better approach here is to lean on America's tradition and principles of free free speech as interpreted through the First Amendment?
I think that's a policy issue. And frankly, in your hypothetical, the Democrats or Republicans only, I think the opposing party would have standing to challenge that that provision, but not the foreigners themselves. And indeed, our immigration provisions could be written differently. There is plenary authority that Congress has to write our immigration rules in a whole host of ways. And because foreigners don't have constitutional rights, there's, again, it's a policy issue.
So it seems like there is at least some agreement that this is an incredibly broad power given to the secretary. And it's an incredibly broad and not terribly well-defined power that's given to the secretary here. And so, I'll ask it this way and come maybe to you first, Ilya, on this. Is this a major questions or non-delegation problem? Maybe that is the law as it presently exists, and you would defend it on that ground as a valid exercise of this power as it exists. But is this a non-delegation or major questions issue?
It looks more like non-delegation than major questions. I'm not sure this is, you know, major questions as defined in terms of important cultural or economic impact. Maybe it's reaching the level of important cultural impact or social impact or whatever, but I think non-delegation is the much clearer hook. That's right. Just like in the Gundy case, that under a different composition of the court, I think would have gone a different way. When you just say, you know, and the executive shall define who's excludable or who makes themselves removable or something like that. Yeah, I think that is a delegation issue.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, this is I'm often making the case that.
Yeah, more than vagueness. That's very good to point that out, Casey. Yeah, this is, again, we shouldn't be thinking through, even though all three of us here are, you know, made our bones on the First Amendment stuff. I think, this is not fundamentally a First Amendment thing. It's a government structure thing.
Connor, if you had any thoughts on that?
Just briefly, obviously we view it very much as a constitutional thing. We view, you know, if you look at the text of the First Amendment, the prohibition against abridgments of speech is not confined to citizens. It prohibits Congress broadly from passing any law abridging the freedom of speech. We know from decisions that non-citizens are also afforded the rights under the Second Amendment, and they have the right against unreasonable search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment that can be enforced in terms of a motion to suppress. So the idea that there's some class of constitutional rights that can just be lightened when it comes to non-citizens is not only, we think, antithetical to principles of freedom of speech, but it's antithetical to how we treat other constitutional rights for example, permanent residents.
All right, I'm going to come to a question here. Roger Klein has this one for Connor, and I might expand it just a little bit. He's asking, under the U.S. Code, it's illegal to provide material support to foreign terrorist organizations. Is that unconstitutional if that support that you're charged with is in the form of speech, distribution of propaganda, violent disruption? Maybe the last one is the challenge, right? Or is the one that would be the outlier in that sentence? But basically, how do you think about support for a terrorist organization? You're a citizen. You're charged with a crime supporting a terrorist organization, and the First Amendment implications of a law like that, if what you're talking about is support in the form of speech.
Right. So my answers to your hypotheticals would have been yes, yes, and no. And the reason we know that is from the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project case from the Supreme Court about 15 or so years ago, which addressed the federal statute regarding material support to terrorism. And the court did a very, very careful job to separate out material support for terrorism from mere advocacy for the kind of for the concept of terrorism. And so the easy way to think about where the First Amendment draws the line is that moral support for terrorism is protected by the First Amendment. Material support is not. You can send your thoughts and your prayers to a terrorist. You cannot send them a Kalashnikov. And I think that is a line that the Supreme Court, carefully and thoughtfully drew in Holder, and the same principles apply here. If all you're doing is talk and voicing an opinion, that does not rise to the level of material support under Holder.
But coordinating with terrorist organizations, or if there's a chain up to them ultimately, and then you're acting as their PR agent, not sending Kalashnikov, but giving interviews or, you know, heading rallies and things like that, that counts too.
Well, the problem with that is, and let's use a historical example from about 70 years ago. If what we're going to say is that if you are espousing views, and I'm right here, I'm spotting because I think it would fall on the other side of the line under Holder, if there's actual tangible coordination between the terrorist organization and the individual. I think, yeah, you and I both agree that that would be different. I'm talking about just, hey, I saw what this group is doing online. I think they're doing a great job, and I'm going to go make a speech about how great of a job I think it is. The problem is, and where that starts abutting free speech, is the idea that we are going to determine that certain groups must not be advocated for if we think of them as terrorists. And think about the troubles in Ireland. Think about what would have happened if we made it a crime to espouse any of the goals that the Irish Republican Army endorsed. You would have
a lot of that fundraising in Boston really was problematic if foreigners were doing, yeah.
Right. And so that's how this can get really problematic. And so that's why we need to keep that line between advocacy and action so sacrosanct, because it is so dangerous to give the government the ability to wave a magic wand and say these opinions are off limits because we say so.
All right. I'm going to ask this is maybe the closing question, and let you both kind of answer here. But because it seems like this is where we kind of keep coming back to this in this conversation. Does it matter? How much does it matter? What basis the government gives for a deportation decision versus the arguments that are available to the government, right? When you have a circumstance where a person could be deported, many of the comments in the chat and the questions are pointing to things that have occurred at Columbia, even things that people believe and even have good reason to probably believe that he individually may be connected to in some way. But oftentimes those aren't the things that are actually being cited right now. How much does it matter what the government cites versus what the government could cite? And we'll come to you, Connor, and then to you, William.
I think it matters a great deal just for simple principles of due process. And I'd analogize it to a criminal trial. Imagine if you think you're going to be going to a criminal trial for, I don't know, jaywalking or a DUI, but when you get there, they start putting on evidence alleging that you committed a murder. And now all of a sudden you're faced with the jury deciding whether you should be convicted of murder. The reason that we want clarity in terms of what grounds the government is relying on to deport someone is so that individual has due process, so they can know what the charges and the accusations are against them. They can respond to them with facts or legal arguments to the extent they have facts or legal arguments to rebut it. And that's how we know whether someone has in fact committed a deportable offense. Due process has been incredibly important since the founding of this country, since John Adams defended British soldiers. Due process is who we are in the United States. And that's why it is so important, even for individuals that many of us find incredibly unsympathetic, to make sure that we are dotting our I's and crossing our T's, because that is what makes America different, our respect for the rule of law, even when it comes to people who make our blood boil.
Elliot?
This is coming up a lot in the different context of the Enemy Aliens Act that's being invoked for the first time, well, only for the fourth time ever, but for the first time in a non-war situation, where the basic due process is ascertaining that someone actually is in the country illegally and involved with a gang or whatever the, you know, part of the quote unquote invasion from Venezuela, what have you. That is often the only process that's due for someone who's not on, who has something less than a green card. And so if you're here illegally, you know, if you're caught at the border, you can just be summarily ejected. You don't have to appear before even an ALJ or an ILJ, immigration law judge. You can just be summarily, driven and back across the border in that case. There are problems if someone claims asylum, of course, which we're dealing with now in our national discourse. Somewhat similar things here. So if you're on a student visa, again, less than Khalil, not a green card, which has, you know, full legal hearing, judge, whatever. But if you're on a student visa, like I think the Turkish student, some of these others, you get a notice of that your visa has been revoked. I think in the statute, the government is supposed to state very kind of simply what the reason is, you know, violation of some statutory provision. That's all you get. And you don't get to challenge that unless it's mistaken identity or some very narrow, you know, jurisdictional grounds of some sort. But you don't get a full blown judicial hearing on the merits of that. That's just the way our our immigration law works. And I think that's right. Because the process that's due, the rights that people have do sometimes depend on whether they're a citizen or not. And in this case, citizens and non-citizens have the same speech rights, same First Amendment rights with respect to the criminal justice system, but they do not with respect to the immigration system.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been great. And I'll invite Caroline back to close us out. And thank you. And thank you to FedSoc for making this possible.
Yes. I just want to echo Casey and thank our panelists for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.